This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, President Trump's executive orders on immigration and a series of nationwide ICE arrests have Charlotte's immigrant community on edge, and they made their presence known in Charlotte yesterday. Governor Roy Cooper proposes a compromise to end HB2 and is hit with criticism from both sides of the issue. Former Governor Pat McCrory continues to defend HB2 and is now talking up the Trump administration. Former County Manager Harry Jones dies from cancer, and a local group takes home a Grammy. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. And we are joined by WFAE reporters Tom Bullock and Michael Tomczyk. Welcome.
Happy Friday.
Good morning.
Yes. Mary C. Curtis, columnist at Roll Call, contributor to NBC BLK and WCCB News Rising, is with us. Good morning to you. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mike.
And Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com, has returned. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And you can reach us through the program, through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook. Reach us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and you can use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. No, that is not the sound of the Donald Trump press conference yesterday. That is the sound from the march that took place in downtown Charlotte during the Day Without Immigrants. The big news here is that more than 7,000 people, possibly closer to 8,000 people, marched downtown at noon yesterday in protest of Trump administration policies. This happened around the country, but the turnout here seemed to be particularly surprising, was it not, Tom?
I was at the rally, and I was surprised by it. I mean, there have been, other rallies that have gone on. This certainly is not to the level of, say, the Women's Day March here in Charlotte. But seeing 7,000 to 8,000 people starting at Marshall Park and then marching around the government center to protest and to show support for what they called a day without immigrants, it was a powerful scene.
About 250 businesses, I'm told, closed yesterday in support of this day without immigrants, including Compare Foods. Were most of these businesses Latino-owned, Hispanic-owned, or catering to that community, or did they run the gamut? Because some restaurants in other parts of the country had to close because, let's face it, their kitchen staff wasn't available to them.
Yeah, and I don't know the exact breakdown of the 250 or so businesses that closed. Some certainly made a point of saying this was in solidarity. Uh-huh. This was about a cause, not just necessarily their workforce or the fact that they were a Hispanic-owned business. But it did make an impact. And again, this was just 250 or so businesses in our area. This was a national campaign.
Right, right. Mary Curtis.
Yes. I saw a spot on a manufacturer in Charlotte who is not Hispanic, but most folks in his workforce were. And he wanted them to come to work, but he gave them time to have their own little mini demonstration. And he basically said, I'm in solidarity because we really depend on these folks. I was downtown here probably about 3 in the afternoon, and there were still quite a few people around who just were coming around here. I think that it is a surprise to some people when they see things like this in a Charlotte because they still don't realize the impact of the Hispanic community in the South. They think it's still a black and white paradigm where actually 8 of the 10 states with the fastest growing Hispanic population are in the South, which the Nueva Evolution exhibit at the Levine pointed out.
Yeah, and one of the things I thought that was interesting, and specifically with just protest signs, which I went down to just take some pictures of and kind of do a little story on, there were lots of signs about the history of America. We are a nation built on immigrants, the founding fathers. We're immigrants or children of immigrants. But some of there was one guy in particular who had a sign that really took this personal, local. It basically started off saying, we are not criminals. We cut your lawns. We clean your houses. We cook your foods. We make this place great. And that was really kind of a bigger message there. There were a couple different buckets
of the
signs.
They also make it run.
That's right. I mean, the American economy is not exactly a fine-tuned machine if it's not for the fact that immigrant workers play a major role. And that's always been the conundrum when it comes to America's immigration policy because our economy does rely in part on immigrant labor. If you doubt that, just think of the cost of food. If you didn't have itinerant workers, largely immigrants, many of them illegal immigrants, who go through and pick the crops that you find on your grocery store shelves.
When folks start paying $20 for a head of lettuce, they'll figure it out.
Glenn Birkin.
What I admire is exactly what you pointed out.
this movement is about more than just a social cause. It's become an economic cause. And that harkens back to some of the earlier boycotts, the Montgomery bus boycott of the civil rights movement. But we're not seeing that so much anymore. So I think the Latino community was very smart in making this about economics and not just about their right to be here.
Michael Thompson.
And to pick up on Glenn's point, one of the things that I think a lot of people don't realize is immigrants, including immigrants from the seven countries that are part of Trump's temporary travel ban, make up a significant portion of doctors in America. There is this medical program that allows overseas residents to come in, and if they stay, they often are put in underserved areas. So there are a lot of places in the country, North Carolina included, where in rural areas where it's harder to get doctors, we have immigrant doctors providing a substantial portion of our health care.
You wrote, Mary, a piece for Roll Call because marches have been taking place around the country, and you wrote a piece about various different aspects of this. And you quoted North Carolina Republican Party Executive Director Dallas Woodhouse as affirming the marchers' right to protest, but then saying that the agenda items they support have been soundly rejected at the ballot box by the people of North Carolina. Can it be interpreted as that? Can the sweep of the legislature and the win of President Trump be interpreted that way, or is this an alternative fact, or is this just being tone deaf?
I think it's much more complicated than that. In North Carolina, if you look, Democrats, Republicans, and different causes, it's more split. Redistricting has a lot to do with it. Voting laws, they have a lot to do with it. And look, in the last election, it's true, Trump did win the state, and the legislature is majority, supermajority GOP, but our governor was defeated, unlike Republican governors throughout the country. And how much of that is because of the activism that you see? You see William Barber, the Reverend Dr. William Barber, with the Moral Mondays going on for years. And you also see this intersectionality, not only with different groups of immigrant groups, but in the marches here, you see different causes. It's very diverse, multi-age, multi-ethnic, and you see folks marching about environmental causes, criminal justice, health care, racial justice, and you really do see that. So I think to dismiss it would be as foolhardy as some folks dismissed Tea Party demonstrations when they first started out, and people said, oh, it's a fake movement, and people are paying for it, and they had a big impact. So you'll see, I think, these grassroots efforts around the country, but I think North Carolina is one of the states that's shown how, you know what, you have to be on that ground, you have to be working hard.
Tom.
I think Mary's exactly right. There's an additional thing I just want to point out, though, which is something you see all across the country. I mean, there's a reason there are reliably red states and reliably blue states, or more importantly here, reliably red counties and reliably blue counties, and that's in cities you have a large percentage of cities that are dominated by Democrats. If you actually look at the state of North Carolina, the Democratic Party has far more voters registered as Democrats than the Republican Party. That's one of the big political divides here is you have Democrats clustered and Republicans kind of spread out. And that's one of the reasons that you end up with Republican supermajorities in the North Carolina House and Senate, but a Democratic government.
But Democrats around the country, not just here, have been saying that the only way Republicans can win anymore is by gerrymandering and playing with the rules, the voting rules, trying to change how voting happens. Is that really the case? And is that why you can say the director of the North Carolina Republican Party can say what he said?
I'm never going to try to figure out exactly why Dallas Woodhouse says anything. That's a slippery slope, to say the least. But no, I disagree with the premise there. The Republicans can win on other issues. They can win on issues. They can win by ways that aren't cheating. Now, in individual instances in states, when it comes to things like gerrymandered districts here in North Carolina, the federal courts have found to be illegal racial gerrymanders. Yes, that is going on.
Yeah.
Why are they doing it? That's a whole separate subject. But yes, they can win on other issues.
Glenn?
I agree with Mary that it's very complex, but I don't entirely dismiss what Dallas Woodhouse said. Even while the left has been winning so much of the cultural war, the Republicans have been winning politically. You can look at it nationally. You can look at it in state races. When President Obama took office, Democrats had a slight majority in state houses. It's not even close anymore. So while the Democrats appear to be winning on issues like gay marriage, and you might even argue immigration and some other issues, the Republican Party continues to pick up ground despite that. So I think we can't dismiss the fact that something out there is happening. Voters are, they are connecting somehow with voters.
Well, there's anger in the country, which is what we saw during the election, but there's also now anger in the immigrant community. We heard some, we could play a little piece of audio yesterday from the march. This is Alicia Benitez, who spoke at the march yesterday downtown.
We are here because we're tired of immigration terrorizing our communities. We're here because we're tired of ICE and the cops terrorizing our communities.
Now, we did an entire program on this yesterday about the fear in the immigrant community resulting from President Trump's executive orders and ICE roundups here and around the country, and there still seems to be some confusion as to what the administration's policy is, how it's filtered down through the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, and who exactly ICE has been targeting in these raids. Can you clear this up, Tom Bullock?
No. Nobody can. And I don't mind saying that. I mean, realistically, you have dueling narratives here. And these narratives are what's sowing the seeds of confusion and fear. The first narrative is coming from people on the ground, members of the immigrant community that have seen what they say is an increase in apprehensions by ICE. You know, there's talk of roadblocks. There's talk of sweeps. There's all these things that they say are going on. And then you have ICE coming out and saying, definitively, we are not doing anything that is outside the norm. Now, that seems to not necessarily be the case. There has been an uptick in arrests by ICE, in detentions by ICE. I mean, we've had, 84 people here in North Carolina rounded up by ICE. You are hearing stories about changes in policy from an executive action signed by Donald Trump that says, you know, we're broadening the definition of who is eligible for deportation. So you hear about the mother in Arizona. You hear about a dreamer that has been arrested by ICE, taken into custody, and now is going to be deported. You see this change from what the Obama administration originally set out, which was felons, not families. And now, and this was clear at the march, you have families being afraid that it's now families and everyone else that's going to
be. But how much of the fear is being driven by actual policy and also actual things going on versus what's being reported on social media, which we all know cannot be necessarily the truth?
Well, I'll take this. There's a very fascinating story in the Washington Post that talks about what they describe as, in essence, a sweep in Fairfax County, Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C., where they were just kind of grabbing immigrants and putting them in the back of this van. Now, that's in the Washington Post, you know, an outlet that Trump says is full of fake news, but you know, let's face it, they're pretty reliable news source. So you hear these stories, and until we get definitive word one way or the other, it doesn't matter what we can necessarily verify because the fear is out there and those stories are getting reported and there is reason to report them.
Glenn Birkins and Mary C. Curtis want to chime in on this, and we'll do that when we come back, and we'll talk some more about this unrest in the immigrant community and the fact that ICE is saying that they are just doing what they always do. There's been no uptick. There's been no change in the way they operate. We'll talk about that when we come back as well. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Nexen Pruitt, lawyers helping companies meet business challenges in court with regulators and at the deal table with offices in Charlotte and 7 other Carolina locations. Next challenge, next level, Nexen Pruitt. Our state is home to nearly 800,000 military veterans and home to the most populous U.S. military installation, Fort Bragg. So the needs of veterans here is particularly high, and the return home for these men and women can be sometimes often difficult difficult and very long because they come back with a number of traumatic injuries. We talk about the reintegration of these vets into post-combat life with participants in the upcoming conference on that topic that will take place, I believe, next week at UNC Charlotte. That'll be Monday on this program at 9. And by the way, we're hosting a public conversation about immigration policy enforcement and its impact on the immigrant community on Tuesday, February 28th at 7. You can get details at WFAE.org.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Michael Flynn fired calls to investigate Trump's Russia ties, Netanyahu at the White House, California's dam crisis. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The weekly roundup of news continues with On Point at 10, here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Tom Bullock and Michael Tomsic from WFAE News. Glenn Brookins is here, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com, and Mary C. Curtis, columnist and reporter for Roll Call and NBC BLK, and many other entities. We're talking about the unrest in the immigrant community, which was on display loud and clear yesterday in Charlotte with about 8,000 people downtown protesting what ICE has been doing. ICE says they're just doing what they always do, targeting individuals already identified as violating immigration laws, and the number of arrests is steady at about 200 per week. I think last week they picked up 100 undocumented immigrants in both Carolinas, 84 here, 19 in South Carolina. Glenn.
Yes, I was saying when it comes to trying to figure out who we should believe, ICE or what we're reading and hearing and seeing on social media, I think some perspective is important. Just a few years back, ICE was doing workplace raids all across the nation, including here in North Carolina. They would go into factories and just raid the entire place. We're not seeing that anymore. I think the more pertinent question is, are we at the beginning of another wave of that? Mm-hmm. I think everyone would acknowledge that we're seeing something happen that we didn't see just last year or even the year before.
But Mary, you wanted to talk about something we talked a little bit about yesterday with Alan Gordon, who's an immigration attorney, the fact that some people are here on, Michael, you called it, what? Well, I'm sorry, I can't remember.
Suspended sentences,
and they have to, it's like being on parole in a way, and that you have to check in every once in a while with an official.
Yeah, and there's
and
families.
And people are afraid to do that.
Yeah, their families caught in the middle. Folks said, you know, I'm undocumented, but as long as you check in with the officials, and some of these folks have been here for decades. And now they're apprehensive. They don't want to not report. At the same time, they are breaking the law just being here. So if they report, they could be swept up.
And if they don't report, they're breaking the law and they could be swept up.
Yes.
Rocking a hard place here.
And a lot of this is family members,
right?
Because you might have a parent who is undocumented, but the children were born in this country. And so now you see a lot of them also are making arrangements. If something happens, what will happen to my children?
Yeah. Michael.
This context, I think, is really important because, and Tom mentioned the phrase earlier, you know, felons versus families. There were a lot of Latinos who called former President Obama the deporter in chief.
Yeah.
I mean, we had record numbers of immigrants deported under President Obama. What we're trying to figure out right now is one thing that could be different, and what we're hearing on the ground is different, is that there are more folks who do not have criminal records besides being here illegally who are being deported. I think it's too early to know for sure if that's playing out. The other thing that is a concrete difference that's, I think, leading to all of this fear is the rhetoric. I mean, of course, Trump campaigned on a platform of build the wall and deport more immigrants.
Well, at a news conference this week, he said he wanted to deport undocumented immigrants who have committed serious crimes. He said, and I quote, "We will get the criminals out, the drug lords, the gang members. We're getting them out. We're going to get the bad ones, the really bad ones. We're getting them out. And that's exactly what we're doing." So in this region, in this roundup of 127 people, is that who they got out?
We don't know. They won't put out the details on exactly who they rounded up.
Why not? Is that normal course of events?
You know, I don't deal with ICE directly enough to know the answer to that, but I can tell you for sure that there have been repeated questions, and they have not released those details. I know David Borax, one of our reporters, it took him forever just to get a firm number of how many people in North Carolina had been rounded up. That's a number that's not really controversial or shouldn't be hard to get if, in fact, an agency is just going about daily business.
I saw some national numbers that indicated that the majority were people with criminal records. Some of them were for things like driving while intoxicated. They weren't all murderers, but there were people without criminal records who were definitely caught up in that as well.
And you know, one thing I want to say is we've talked about this a lot on a big, like the 35,000-foot Trump administration kind of way. This is something that's also playing out right now in the General Assembly. Mm-hmm. There are not one but two bills that deal with illegal immigrants that have been introduced by Republican George Cleveland from Onslow County. The first one would withhold money from cities that are deemed to be in violation of an earlier state law from 2015 that banned sanctuary cities, a term that is now a lot of people hear about. That could cost Charlotte about $20 million in specific funds. But he put out another one yesterday that would make it possible for individual citizens to sue cities, counties, police departments directly, which is, you know, they have to take kind of a change of law to do that. And the fines could be up to $10,000 a day if they are not enforcing federal policy. Now, federal policy is normally enforced by federal agencies. So that bill in particular is really interesting because it would be the closest thing you have to a mandate that, say, the CMPD actually starts enforcing federal immigration policy.
I want to come back to that in a second, but I also want to come back right now to the number of people that they got out of here, 127 people. They say ICE says they caught 127 people with prior criminal convictions in addition to their illegal status. 29 had been previously removed from the country but returned. 17 had outstanding final orders from a federal judge to leave. It also seems odd that it's so difficult to get numbers out of ICE. If the president is on this campaign that he's been on since he was campaigning to be the president of wanting to get illegal residents out of the country, wouldn't he want people to know the number of people that he's getting out of the country on a daily basis or a weekly basis?
Especially since he tweeted that these were raids.
Yeah.
That's a fair question. I think you bring up a really important number. That's 17. 17 people who had been ordered by a federal judge to be deported. Those are exactly the kind of people that Michael Tomczyk was talking about. These are people who have been found to have been entered the country illegally, mm-hmm. and that you know, that basically immigration officials said, "Look, check in with us. You know, we're not going to deport you. You're not worth the cost to deport. You're not doing anything bad now, but you need to check in with us in order to make sure that you're on that path." Yeah. So that's the closest thing we have to a quantifiable number of the people who have been, you know, swept up.
So the Charlotte Mayor Jennifer Roberts has said repeatedly that Charlotte is not a sanctuary city, but some Raleigh lawmakers, including former city council member and now Republican legislator Andy Doolin, are saying that her comments could persuade, and you alluded to this a second ago, could persuade officials that the city is not following state law and could cost us more than $20 million. What did she say that was interpreted in a way that they feel that money is in jeopardy?
I mean, in a nutshell, she's trying to walk this line where it's, you know, we are not violating laws, but we're trying to be welcoming. But when you boil down to what it is that we're doing, I mean, the only thing that would make us sanctuary is if we flat out tell our officers, you are not allowed to ask immigrants of their status, which we do not.
Which we cannot.
Exactly. What we do, and Chief Putney laid this out on this show
yesterday,
24 hours ago, quite neatly, is he says that to tell officers it's not relevant unless it is involving someone who is committing a crime.
And he says we are in compliance with state and federal laws. And here's – I asked him about that, in fact. You're saying that we are right to the letter following the state law.
Yes, we are. The legislation on the state or federal level does not compel us to inquire about immigration status. Therefore, we do not. If we were compelled, it'd be a different story. And the other thing, Mike, is I'm not here to thumb my nose at the federal government. Many of the federal agencies are very good partners of ours, which help us improve the safety and maintain safety in our city. However, the confusion is around what our role is in enforcing those immigration laws, and we don't have one.
We don't have a role in enforcing those laws, and we went through this for about 10 minutes yesterday. I asked him as many ways I could possibly think to get a solid answer, and I got a solid answer every time that we are in compliance with this. So why in Raleigh all this, particularly from the Mecklenburg County delegation, why all of this stuff going on?
It's a good question, and it may be some confusion about which law enforcement does which thing. Because, for example, our sheriff, so as soon as someone is arrested and they go to jail in Mecklenburg County, at that point, immigration status does get checked because our sheriff's department runs the jails. CMPD essentially hands people off at the jails. Mm-hmm. And sheriffs are part of a voluntary program called 287G, where they then check immigration status. So if you get arrested in this county, your immigration status is getting checked by local law enforcement.
Right.
It's just not CMPD, and CMPD is not checking it when they happen to stop someone
and,
or talk to someone
the
around the community.
And the police chief pointed out yesterday several times that there are lots of federal laws that we do not enforce.
Right.
That's why we have the FBI. That's why we have ICE. We don't do that.
Yeah, I think the most – a really good example that he had is – they don't go after tax cheats. That's the IRS's job. But to get to your point about why members of the General Assembly think Charlotte may be breaking the law, first of all, breaking news. The General Assembly doesn't really like Charlotte's mayor very much or the city council very much. But there is this opinion, and actually going back to Representative Cleveland, the person I told you about that and introduced the two bills, he was asked by WRAL specifically, do you think cities are violating the 2015 law that bans sanctuary cities in the state? And he said yes, but he will not say which ones. Well, there are only so many cities where this could actually be taking place. And, you know, there just is no – there's still no love between Charlotte and Raleigh, and this is just another sign of an amazing level of distrust.
But you have to feel for the chief, because when you ask what his mission is, well, to solve crimes in Charlotte, Charlotte-Mecklenburg, and they are focused on the victims, the criminals, and solving these crimes. And he doesn't need this. He's getting enough pressure on other issues that are happening in the city, and he doesn't need this. So I thought you did a great job giving him a chance to lay out exactly what they have to do here.
I also think there's the spirit of the law and the letter of the law. I think when it comes to the letter of the law, Charlotte might be in compliance. But I think Raleigh has a pretty good idea of where our elected leaders
are. Well, are we alone? What's the situation in Raleigh? What's the situation in Chapel Hill? What's the situation in Greensboro?
I certainly don't think we're alone.
In Asheville and Winston-Salem, I mean, these are all places that Republican lawmakers at one point or another have questioned whether or not they were, as you say, Glenn, and it's a great point to bring up,
and there's
whether
so many
in the
other
spirit or the letter of the law.
There's so many other challenges. You're hearing from parents in schools and kids in schools now. What are we going to do there? They're going to stop at the bus stop. So cities are dealing with a lot of more on-the-ground issues that probably folks in the state, you know, aren't quite as sympathetic to.
So let's go back to this march yesterday where 8,000 people showed up, almost 8,000 people showed up, which I think surprised a lot of people. I think they thought it was going to be around 1,000 people who were going to show up for this. And it was a day without immigrants across the country. What was the impact of that, both in businesses, which about 250 closed, on just employees at general offices? What happened at the schools? Because there was a thought that a lot of kids would stay home from school to participate in this march or just stay home, and CMS requested that they come. Did they?
You know, when you're talking about 8,000 overall and then the massive size of CMS, you know, some students were clearly at the rally. Our reporter Nick De La Canal talked to one high school student who said, you know what, this is more important. I need to come out and show solidarity with my community. I saw quite a few kids that were there with their parents. So, you know, I don't think any significant numbers, but there's certainly kids who were there.
And you brought up, Mary, the bus stop situation, and school board member Elise Dashew reported that ICE officials have assured school leadership that schools and school bus stops are considered to be safe from any immigration law enforcement activity. So does that mean they will not make arrests either at schools or at school bus stops?
Well, that's what they're saying, though folks have said we have seen ICE officials, and that gets to a bit of what Tom was talking about, that the reports are mixed, and you can see where the school board has its own mission, which is to assure safety and that the kids will come to school and learn. So ICE is saying it, but as Glenn has said, is this the beginning of an atmosphere where you feel that you have to look over your shoulder even when you're going to school?
So WFAE is hosting a public conversation on immigration policy and enforcement and its impact on the immigrant community, and by extension, I would think its impact on the community at large. That'll be Tuesday, February 28th at 7 p.m. We have details on that because we'd like to have you in attendance for that. It's a public conversation, after all. Details at WFAE.org. Let's move on to something that might shock a lot of people, Mike. Michael Tomczyk. You reported earlier this week on the startling, and that's an interesting word, the startling rise of heroin use in the Charlotte area. Jill Westmoreland Rose, the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina, says it's a problem that began with prescription pills, and that comment was echoed by the acting administrator of the DEA, Chuck Rosenberg, who was also in town this week.
We know that 4 out of 5 new heroin users start on prescription pills. And most of those folks get those pills from a medicine cabinet, from a friend. If you get hooked on pain pills, it becomes awfully expensive to feed that habit on the street. 30 milligram pill will cost you $30. That's not sustainable. Heroin is cheaper, more readily available, and so people make that transition.
Was he here specifically to hammer that point home, or was he here for other reasons as well?
Exactly, to hammer that point home. Our U.S. attorney, as you mentioned, Mike, Jill Westmoreland Rose, has been really pushing this issue lately. So there was a conference this week that the DEA head was in town for to take part in that basically just tried to define what this problem is and look at some potential solutions. As far as defining the problem, I mean, the numbers, Rosenberg, the DEA head, called them astonishing. Between 2010 and 2015, heroin deaths went up 550% in North Carolina. And as he laid out there, essentially this is the next chapter of our country's opioid epidemic. It's been going on for a long time. It's a major problem, and that epidemic is essentially we have vastly overprescribed prescription painkillers to the point that there's the U.S. Attorney Rose said that there are 91 prescriptions for every 100 North Carolina residents.
Wow.
And that's true in a lot of the United States.
So we've overprescribed, and now are they not more carefully controlling those prescriptions so that if you become hooked, legitimately hooked essentially on these legitimately prescribed prescriptions and they're suddenly no longer available to you, you're seeking out heroin, which is a substitute and a lot cheaper.
Yeah, it's not so much, though, that the heroin spillover is not because we're getting better at prescribing necessarily. It's more so just because more and more people are getting addicted.
Mm.
And this, as Rosenberg just laid out, as we just heard, it becomes a lot cheaper to switch to heroin. Heroin is also an opioid. So heroin and prescription painkillers are both types of opioids. So they affect the brain in the exact same way. And opioids, while there is a perfectly acceptable use of them, as you mentioned, Mike, the way they work, even when they're working correctly, they rewire the brain. So doctors will say after 2 weeks of opioid use, you will already be at a point where if you just stop, you will have some amount of withdrawal. So these are just incredibly addictive medicines that can be used appropriately for pain, mm-hmm. but we established in our healthcare field over the past 2 decades, we're just going to prescribe these and prescribe these and prescribe these. And now there's so many of them out there that the problem is still too much availability. And even as the availability is being trimmed back some with better prescribing practices, you have the spillover effect into heroin.
So are the deaths that are being attributed to an increase in heroin use because people are taking too much of it or because you can't control the quality of the heroin and they're putting all kinds of things in it like fentanyl, which is, 80 times more addictive or something like
that?
Yeah, it's
a great point, and it's both. So, obviously you can just die from heroin. You can die from prescription painkillers.
Sure.
The bulk of – this is worth pointing out. The bulk of deaths in this opioid epidemic are still from the painkillers. They're not from heroin. Heroin's a growing portion of it, but it's a small part of the overall whole because most people are still ODing on the pills. But to your point, fentanyl as an example, we're finding – law enforcement said this week – we're finding more of that here in the Charlotte area, and that leads to more deaths.
And there appears to be a different approach to this addiction epidemic than previous drug epidemics, and we'll talk about that and other things when we come back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Jazz Arts Initiative presenting the Jazz Room Trumpet Summit featuring 5 of the region's accomplished jazz trumpeters today and tomorrow at the Blumenthal Stage Door Theater. Tickets at blumenthalarts.org. President Trump's national security advisor resigns amid calls to investigate the Trump administration's connections with Russia. The president's labor secretary pick bows out and Israel's prime minister visits the White House. Just some of the stories they'll be talking about on the national edition of the Roundup with Tom Ashbrook on Point. coming up in just about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can reach us at WFAE.org or CharlotteTalks at WFAE.org, or search for WFAE on Facebook, or reach us through Twitter at CharlotteTalks and use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. We're coming right back.
Next time on The World, the stars of Korean pop music are not born. They're trained and molded to perfection. And now you too can learn to be a K-pop star. You don't have to live in Korea or be from Korea, but you must learn to speak Korean.
It's actually my hardest challenge because my Korean sucks.
We go to school at a K-pop academy in New York City. That's on The World.
The World, coming up at 3 on 90.7 WFAE. Listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Glenn Birkins from Q-City Metro, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call, WCCB, News Rising, NPR, blah, blah, blah. Michael Tomsik is here from WFAE News, and so is Tom Bullock, also from our news department. And we were talking just before the break about the epidemic of heroin use in North Carolina, and both the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina, Jill Westmoreland Rose, has talked about this week, as did the acting administrator of the DEA. Unlike the previous war on drugs, which has been going on since, what, the Nixon administration? Jill Westmoreland Rose says that law enforcement cannot arrest itself out of this. We can't arrest our way out of this. It's an epidemic. It's also been reclassified as an illness. So is there a treatment plan?
Absolutely. And this is something that the medical profession is now lockstep in agreement on. Addiction is a chronic illness. It is literally a disease of the brain. And for that reason, you need actual treatment for it. When you look at, for example, the death rates for people who just tried detox versus people who use medication-assisted treatment, they are vastly better for the people who go into some kind of actual treatment. And the analogy you hear a lot nowadays is, think about high blood pressure. Think about diabetes. You wouldn't tell a diabetic, hey, we need you to just quit sugar, cold turkey, and good luck. This is an illness that you need to be treated for, and there are now different types of medication that can help wean people off of this opioid addiction.
So is this now an official national approach to this?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
We have tons of people in jails and prisons right now who are there because of drug use. Are we going to let them out and give them mental health treatment?
Well, I should draw a line between – so there are lots of drug use, heroin included, that's still illegal. But the bulk of the opioid epidemic is still tied to people who are addicted to pills they were prescribed by their doctor. So there is somewhat of a distinction in that it is easier from a law enforcement perspective to say, in those types of, you know, doctor-prescribed addiction, we can get you this treatment, potentially, than from addiction to other illicit drugs.
But even with the doctor – prescribed addiction, as you call it, all of the pills that are being taken are not legally obtained.
Right.
There are people who are shopping for doctors and who will prescribe these pills. And
people who are stealing the pills, too.
And I was going to say.
And buying them on the street. And you do see, when the face of addiction was black and brown in years past, that war on drugs, there was not quite the understanding that was a illness. And so let us hope, as you bring up, Mike, that some of the folks in the jail cells who are there for nonviolent drug convictions, you know, they would look on them with understanding.
Possession and use,
they used to just throw you in jail just for use, and that was the war on drugs, and it did fill the prisons.
I think that's a really important point that Mary made. I mean, there has been a very concrete difference in how this epidemic that has hit middle class white America has been treated than how drug epidemics of the past. Now, some amount of that, you could argue at least, is that we're getting better at the actual medicinal diagnosis side of it and figuring out really how addiction works. But it's probably, I mean, it's just a simple fact that Mary pointed out that is important to note that fits into how people respond to these changing guidelines.
As long as we're talking to you, last year, Charlotte saw a rise in the crime rate, including the murder rate. And so far this year, there have been 11 homicides, and police have identified four areas that they are experiencing these higher crime rates in, and they plan to target. They have been targeting those areas. How?
They have this operation called Operation Avalanche. Major Mike Smathers from CMPD talked to some of us about it earlier this week. The idea is to use a data-driven approach to focus on those four areas where violent crime has been up. They are actually using some data analysis to figure out certain times of the day or night to have extra officers there. That means extra undercover. That means extra uniformed, more contact with residents. It's too early to say exactly how effective that is, that he couldn't give me an answer for do they think this is having an effect on homicides. But he did say that so far they do think it's having an effect on at least bringing down violent crime overall.
And those areas are Central Avenue and Eastway, the Plaza and Eastway, Milton Road and Sharon Amity, and the Sugar Creek I-85 corridor. This actually started 3 weeks ago. I asked the police chief about this yesterday, and I asked him, why tell people where you are? Why are they telling people where they are?
They're trying to knock out so they're not just doing undercover. They have more uniforms in those areas. They want people to know, we are going to see what you're doing.
But doesn't that cause people to say, well, we can't do it there, so let's go over here where they're not?
I suppose we'll find out.
Okay. All right. The state is facing a swiftly approaching deadline. And a matter of fact, this is the NBA All-Star Weekend, which was to have been here in Charlotte. It is now in New Orleans. But the NCAA is going to make a decision about where the next 6 years of tournament games are going to be played. And we stand to lose $250 million as they take them away from North Carolina. So Governor Cooper, who has been challenged by the legislature to offer a solution, did, and was immediately criticized by people on both sides of the issue about his proposal. What did his proposal suggest?
A full repeal of House Bill 2, additional penalties for any crimes that are committed in public bathrooms or locker rooms or changing facilities, and 30 days heads up to given to voters and state legislature if any city, county, or any other municipality is going to hold a vote about some kind of expansion of a non-discrimination ordinance. And you're exactly right. I mean, look, Tim Moore, House Speaker Tim Moore, and Senate Pro Tem Phil Berger have been saying for weeks, pretty much since it was clear that Democrat Roy Cooper had in fact become governor, that if there was to be any deal, any kind of new repeal of House Bill 2, that he had to be the one to propose a compromise. And if the definition of compromise is that every party involved finds something they don't like about it, that's exactly what he found.
Well, Phil Berger called it a so-called compromise and said that it did nothing to address the basic privacy concerns of women and young girls. But doesn't this proposal basically give us a reset back before Charlotte passed its ordinance so that things return to exactly where they were before Charlotte passed the ordinance? And what kind of protections did we have for young girls and women then?
Well, it's a totally fair point. You could actually argue that we are near a reset as it is, since Charlotte has already rescinded its ordinance. But Berger went farther, and I think this shows the level of political animosity involved here, that it's really not just about House Bill 2. Besides what you said, he went on to say that Governor Roy Cooper absolutely had to come out and say how he felt about men going into women's restrooms. Now, that is just a politically charged statement.
What is to be said about that? What can you possibly say about
it? It's already against the law.
Yeah,
this idea that that's not against the law is just false.
Yeah. I think he wants a little groveling, maybe. I don't know. But basically, citizens here are going to be looking at the All-Star Game on TV, thinking about what might have been.
I mean, do you really think that? I mean, seriously.
If you really love basketball, you will.
If you're a hotel worker or a restaurateur here in Charlotte, or if you are a vendor at the Coliseum, you might think that. But do you think the average person is going to sit in, I don't know, Wadesboro is going to think about that?
Well, I think it's a showcase for the city, as many other things are. And basically, it'll be in the news because we're not doing it. And to think down the road that NCAA, ACC, all these groups are making the decisions and we're cut out of it, I think that is a problem.
And I think that's actually the bigger issue. The All-Star, NBA All-Star game, yeah, I don't see a whole lot of Hornets flags flying out in my neighborhood or neighborhoods I drive around, but I'll tell you what I do see, and that is a bunch of ACC school flags out there. And if that does come to fruition, it will be palpable.
So, I
spent the first part of this week in South Florida, and while there might not be a lot of people here bemoaning the fact that this weekend the All-Star game is going to kick off in New Orleans, HB2.
Not to mix a metaphor or anything like that.
HB2 was all people wanted to talk about when they found out I was from North Carolina.
Oh, wow.
This, aside from the economic damage that this thing has done, it's a huge black eye. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really realize it until I got out of the state. That was all they wanted to talk about. Everywhere I went, people seemed to know about HB2. And they were asking, what are you guys doing up there?
Yeah.
Think about the Jeopardy question. I mean, the fact that it's a Jeopardy question now—that alone—and I don't even mean that as a joke. I mean, it is kind of odd, but the fact that it is so in the nomenclature, it's so out there in the zeitgeist that it can be a question on Jeopardy, lets you know just how prevalent HB2 is.
A family member is planning her organization a convention a couple years down the road, and called me to talk about that. And then you realize how many things we're not getting that we won't even know about because the state is just being written off.
I want to know what category that Jeopardy question fell into. But to be fair to the legislature on this issue, they were not the only critics of Roy Cooper's proposal. The Human Rights Campaign and Equality NC, both LGBT rights groups, also criticized the governor's proposal. What did they say about it? Why?
They said this is a distraction from a clean repeal of House Bill 2. And they're right. I mean, it's about it being another way to go besides a clean repeal of House Bill 2. But again, I fall back to what I said about that classic kind of definition of the word compromise. Mm. The clock is ticking. You know, we had Senator Jeff Tart, Republican from North Mecklenburg County, on our air. Lisa Wharf did the story. And he said something that's fascinating to me, which is – and he is a Republican who early on came out and said, we've got to repeal this. But he came out and said, you know, this is a top of mind – for Republican lawmakers and Democratic lawmakers. This is something that they talk about all the time. They know they need to do it. So if – you know, we have to see if somehow, some way, the two most powerful Republicans either come on board or their caucuses start to kind of move around it. Because, again, that NCAA clock is ticking. And it's also worth pointing out, the NCAA has sent word that Governor Cooper's compromise – would satisfy them and would get North Carolina back on the table for these considerations.
The former governor, Pat McCrory, was on NBC's Meet the Press over the weekend, and he said the state's loss of the NBA All-Star game over HB2 was selective hypocrisy, and he cited the location of the Super Bowl, Houston, Texas, as an example because they have, he says, the exact same law that we have.
No, they don't.
They don't.
They don't.
They don't.
It is not a state law. It is – he's wrong.
It's a proposal.
Yeah. What the similarity that he's pointing to is that both Houston and Charlotte, their city councils passed a non-discrimination ordinance. What's different is in Houston, it was then put to a referendum and 61% of Houston voters rejected it. So the result is the same as in Charlotte in that there's no local protections for LGBT people. But in Charlotte, the state legislature stepped over the city to do that. In Houston, its own voters made that decision.
There is an additional thing that needs to be pointed out, which is the NFL, when they heard that Texas was considering a similar bill to HB2, the NFL said don't, because we will pull the game. And the Texas legislature has stopped advancing that bill.
And I would also go ahead. I would also point out that it's unfair of the former governor to compare the NBA with what the NFL is doing. I don't see it as hypocrisy. I just see them as two different organizations.
Well, speaking of hypocrisy, I mean, if the newspaper story this morning is right, evidently the governor signed that bill within 24 hours, Governor McCrory, because he saw a poll to which he reacted with the word, wow, and the poll said people would like this bill. So he signed it.
Yeah, and that comes from emails from the governor and the governor's staff. This is all through public access, public records request that's been made by a couple of newspapers, including the Charlotte Observer, and it's really providing a whole lot of insight and finally may answer the question of if he had so many concerns about it, concerns he said after the fact, then why did he sign it within hours of it being passed?
We have to switch gears here to something relatively sad, because I think everybody around this table, maybe with one exception, knew and dealt with Harry Jones on a regular basis. Harry Jones was the longtime county manager in Mecklenburg County who had a long fight with pancreatic cancer, and he died this week at the age of 67. He steered this community for more than a decade until the commission decided to let him go for whatever reason. What did happen there?
Well, I think a number of things happened in terms of him being let go. But what I will remember about Harry Jones is the bravery that he showed after he was diagnosed. He made it a mission to reach out to other people who had had similar diagnosis. I met with him for about an hour, about a year ago, and I sat with him at his home. He talked about this disease almost as if it were a blessing. He said it changed his life. It changed his outlook. He talked a lot about forgiving those, or the need and or the importance of forgiving those who had offended you. He was very blunt that this disease made him a better person. He fought hard against it. And unfortunately, it was a battle that he lost in the end. But I think he will be remembered for the compassion and the outreach he showed after his diagnosis.
And he's been eulogized already by people with whom he worked as a visionary leader and somebody who was very important. Pat McCrory also took some time out to say some very nice things about him. And he was, in fact, asked back by the county commission to be awarded the highest award they can give out, the Order of the Hornet.
It was pretty clear at that point that he was in his final days.
There was a ceremony for him this winter, where people came to honor him. I did not go. Someone who was a dear friend who went said he was there on his walker, his cane, and that it was that weekend we had some snow. So it was a little joke that so many people came out despite that, and it was a great chance for someone to hear how much he is loved and appreciated. When he's still here to appreciate that.
Let's leave on a semi-up note. Last Sunday, a Charlotte band heard the magic words, "The winner of the Grammy for Best Bluegrass Album goes to the O'Connor Band." And this is the O'Connor Band and a cut called "Fiddler Going Home." And they came here from New York last spring, I guess. So now they're a Charlotte band, and they won the Grammy. Thank you all for being here for the hour. We'll go out with the O'Connor Band.